This episode of The Bladder Presents is brought to you in part by Best Evidence subscribers. Thanks, guys. At only $5 a month, the paid version of the Best Evidence newsletter makes a great gift and lets you know which true crime properties do keep on giving. And if we get 2,000 paid subscribers by August of 2020, we'll be covering the Theranos trial in person. So think about springing for the paid version today. That's at bestevidence.fyi. And now, on with the episode.
At 13, he was charged as an adult with murder. At 30, he was declared innocent and released from prison. Then he was awarded $25 million in compensation. But Thaddeus Jimenez didn't take his money and move to a tropical island like you and I might have done. He spent the money on a gang.
I might have spent the money on a gang. Anyway, not that Toby Ball and I claim to know the rules of getting away with crimes, but I'd have to guess rule number one is don't go viral on YouTube shooting some random dude for the hell of it. We'll talk more about how that brought TJ Jimenez down, again, when we discuss WBEZ's new podcast, Motive. And in the age of peak true crime, we'd have to say rule number two is probably don't pull a scorched earth scam on a family that contains a radio producer, because you're gonna end up on a podcast like Unravel's fourth season, Snowball. What do we know? We just work here. It's The Bladder Presents, episode 114. Welcome back to The Bladder Presents, a podcast that, when we're not getting in rumbles outside the honey-baked ham store, tries to find the true crime that's worth your time. Always worth your time are the thoughts of my guest, Mr. Toby Ball. Hello, Toby.
Hey, how are you?
I'm not bad. And the first most wanted topic that we're talking about today is also not bad. But I don't know if it's great. It is called Motive. It comes to you from WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times. Let me give you the case file from the podcast's landing page. Quote, it's a cruel sociological experiment. Lock up a 13-year-old boy for a murder that he swore he didn't commit. Release him as a 30-year-old man. Then give him $25 million. Motive is a true crime podcast hosted by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Frank Main with original reporting from the Chicago Sun-Times. End quote. TJ Jimenez is the boy, now man, in question, and he spent at least part of that $25 million creating his own gang, giving them cars and experience gifts, and defending himself in court when, on a viral video, he just straight up shot some guy to seem like a badass. It seems like Motive's name comes from the search for a why in that latter case, but is that the most interesting why available? And will Toby and I keep listening after the two episodes that have already dropped? Toby, will you keep listening?
Good question. No.
Me neither.
In a word. Yeah.
And I really was having trouble getting a handle on why, aside from the fact that there is a, you know, shit ton is the technical term of true crime and podcasts out right now. Like, I feel like just podcasts coming out of Australia, I'm never going to get caught up. We'll get back to it. This is not an uninteresting story. It just was not catching for me. And I wasn't exactly sure why that was. For me, I have a couple of theories. Did you have any sort of grand unifying, this is not for me, zeitgeisty reason that you're like, I'm good?
So I think sort of along what you were saying, there's so much stuff out there now. And I sort of feel like to be sort of must listen, just based on the fact that I listen to so many podcasts. Like, if I'm going to stick with one, I think there needs to be something that stands out about it. And I think that was kind of the issue with me on this one, is that I think it's, you know, it's, it seems like it's well reported. But there's nothing. I think the question that they pose at the beginning, which is what happens when you take a 13-year-old, put him in prison, let him out in his 30s, and then give him $25 million. Like, that's kind of interesting. but they don't, they kind of lose that frame, I feel like.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, they kind of start with the $25 million, and then it takes them a while to get back to what I think is the inciting incident for everything with this guy going forward, which is his getting locked up at 13. There are some interesting sociological aspects to his backstory that they, you know, eventually in episode two, you start to get a more dimensioned picture of how he got to various points. But it's like 2/3 of the way through episode two, by which time I was already kind of like, this is not poorly done. It's not irresponsible. It's just not enough. And there is a little, I'm going to have to redo my the-blotter.com true crime news mag bingo card for true crime podcasts, because every time there's a locution like the one you're about to hear that's a little proud of itself in clip two, I write in my notes SKS for someone knows something, because it's like, why are we hearing you driving and saying this thing that almost nobody would say about like a string of apartment buildings and abandoned lots? Let's hear clip two.
Besides buying fancy cars, TJ uses money to win over gang members on the west side of Chicago, in one of the poorest and most violent neighborhoods in the city.
So the thing about here is that you go down the street and you have this empty lot, building, 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 empty lot. And it's like broken teeth in a mouth.
I mean, it's not like that. I just, like my, and I wonder if your and my patience for this is a lot shorter than civilians. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No. Yeah. I think the other thing that kind of sticks out about this, which makes it maybe not as rewarding an experience as it might be, is that it does kind of seem like a podcast made by print people.
Uh-huh.
And that would be an example of, I've got this cool line. Yeah. I've got to work it in somewhere.
Yeah.
It doesn't flow. It's not natural.
Yeah. I mean, it's actually not a bad line. Like, I think of there are certain blocks, like in kind of the middle of Brooklyn or the Bronx, where that's an excellent, that sort of like jack-o'-lantern street skyline. Sure. Like, that's an apt thing. But you're mentioning that reminds me that I remember thinking, I wish this were just a long-form print article. Or a series, yep. Like BuzzFeed. I don't know. Like, not everything has to be a podcast. And again, this isn't incompetent. But I feel like the way it's set up as an audio story, it's maybe missing some of the real story. Here, this next clip is from Jimenez's attorney. And I'm interested to hear what you think of these comments in clip three.
And I guess I'm sort of confessing here, and maybe it's against my interest, but I regard it as a tremendous failure on my part that when there were stories that TJ was acting like a knucklehead, that I didn't personally put a stop to it.
Through a friend, John started to hear rumors about what TJ was doing with his money. He called TJ and asked what was going on. TJ said he had everything under control.
You know, I wish I had intervened sooner with TJ and stopped it. But then, you know, when I tell myself that and I'm beating myself up, but in some ways TJ was trying to destroy himself. He was a guy just trying to go 100 miles an hour at the edge of the cliff. And life was like giving him, well, here's a bunch of advantages. Here's a bunch of money. He's like, I'm still going to try to destroy myself. In fact, this is going to help me do it better. And that's what happened.
I mean, I think that there is so much to unpack in those comments that is condescending, disingenuous, and inaccurate. But the podcast seems content to run that as just like a good soundbite, I think. Did you have insight. Any particular thoughts about that sequence?
Other than that, it was kind of weird that, like, his attorney is somehow responsible for his personal life choices is strange. I don't know. I mean, I think it advances this story they're trying to tell about this guy who, and again, this is kind of where the condescension comes in a little bit more. It's like, oh, you know, I think it was in the second episode. Somebody says, you know, you think you know what you're going to get when you're talking to this gangbanger guy. But then when you meet him and he's like, actually, he's really smart and, you know, sort of sensitive. It's like, it's making me a little uncomfortable.
Yeah.
That's your attitude about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that comes up a couple of times that they're like, TJ's complicated. He's not just the, you know, shithead, which is the word they use. Amazing. He's extra wrapped in enigma, etc. But like, yeah. are
we watched Apocalypse Now and was like, how can we do this?
But
how can I pull
this
off in the streets of Chicago?
Are we still at a point in true crime narrative where the idea that like intelligence and like criminal motivations can like it's news that coexists, or that I don't know, that it's like, it's interesting that he's playing classical music. I'm like, is it? Like,
yeah, I don't. So this is one of the things that it's like, I'm not quite sure what the thought process was behind all of this, because there is this sort of, the part of the narrative is he's not what you'd expect from a gang person, or he's not like other gang people, when in fact what you hear about in the second episode is that it seems like he's following in an absolutely normal gang path of, you know, does a, you know, single parent family with a mom who works three jobs and isn't around very much. Gang kids in his neighborhood getting a lot of respect and you know, all the girls.
Family who's in the gang. Little right, League version of this. And then his uncles are both in it. And
so it seems absolutely typical. And it seems like the lesson you'd be getting out of it is, you know, like any other group that has tons of people in it, and I'm talking about like just gangs in general,
right?
You're going to get all different types of people.
Yeah.
And this is one type of person, but the idea that he's not like a typical gang person. I mean, I think that's, it's not, you know, and again, I'm not a gang expert. My sense is being in a gang has more to do with socioeconomic and geographical things,
right,
than it does with IQ things. You know, you're born into a place where there are gangs that increases your chances, you know, 100-fold to being involved in them.
Yeah. And also of having enough to eat and surviving, depending on your neighborhood.
Right.
I also,
which I think is a, I think there's an overlap, right?
Yeah,
I
mean,
I
think for that's... sure. And so you could say that the sort of smart or common sense thing to do, like that would be typical of gang members, is that at least in the sense of smarts and self-preservation, that, you know, that is fairly typical for them to display that savvy at least. The other thing that, well, there's two more things that are irritating me right now. One is more general, and that is that I feel like I have an extremely broad strokes idea of like geographic segregation of neighborhoods in Chicago, by which I mean I know one stroke, and that's that exists. And I needed more context about that, based on this guy and sort of the way that a lot of time was spent talking about dog whistles to do with gang activity and, you know, kids being super predators and stuff like that. This definitely was a thing in the 90s. 99% of the time, that was a race dog whistle. The other thing that's irritating to me here is that the attorney is like, he has all these advantages and he's determined to self-destruct. Like, he'd been in prison since he was 13, more than half his life. He, like, you'll see his mugshot in the visual aids. It's like a when they see a situation where you're like, that's a child. Like, I'm not sure how $25 million constitutes advantages when, you know, too much too late. Like, there's just so much here that I think is not necessarily grounded as well as it could be. And then this attorney's comments are not really interrogated by the podcast. So, yeah, that's a bit disappointing. And then there's this moment in the next clip where, as much as I'm a fan of things that you can file to the Sometimes They Catch Themselves folder, here's clip 4.
After TJ had sped off, the police saw him run through a stop sign. There was a brief chase, and TJ crashed his $90,000 Mercedes into a parked car. He was arrested within minutes of the shooting. Inside the car, the cops found Gucci bags filled with ammunition.
I mean, like, this is both good detail and not enough detail.
And what's that music in the background? Yeah. It's so weird. I didn't notice that when I was first listening.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I didn't have much else after that. There's just, like, that clip ties into my overarching sense that this is a, like, the lead is an interesting story, but then that story is always going to give you other stories that kind of perfuse it and inform it. And I'm not convinced that this podcast knows what the real story is. I mean,
yeah,
you know, I like, they don't just give out Pulitzers to anyone. It's not a participation prize. Like, I, you know, I don't know Frank Mean's work, but this does seem a little, maybe this is one of those things where they're like, look, you have to do this extra podcast and we're not going to pay you anymore. So he's like, I'll do a competent job, but I'm not going to kill myself.
But I think part of it, and the more we talk about it, the more I'm sort of feeling more strongly about it, is that, you know, if you are going to get to the interesting things about this story, I think setting it up as stereotype gang people, this guy's not one of them, you know, it's not a good approach to it.
Right.
And then again, this thing like, how could he blow it? We gave him $25 million. How could he not, you know, turn his life around?
I mean, I'll tell you, like, frankly, if you gave me $25 million, jail or no jail, I'm probably going to do some dumb, fucked up shit also. Like, I mean, it's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money, and he came of age in prison.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I've never been to prison. I don't know, like, exactly what that would do, but my sense is it's quite a bit different than being, like, if he was going to college or, you know, just like working somewhere for all that time and like having a family and stuff. It's a different environment. It's different, you know, values, different necessities than you have in the outside world. So when you get out and suddenly you have this money, it's like what has been instilled in you in the past, well, the second half of your life, essentially, all the time that you've been a mature person, it's been in this particular, you know, venue.
Yeah, where you have no control values are over very anything. Different. And there's just, literally yeah, the every values are relationship so different. You have is transactional. Like, this is absolutely predictable.
So
not in the particulars, perhaps. And then there's the issue of his mom, who is a, you know, this is a textured story that she's telling. She's not necessarily sympathetic in it every second, and she knows that better than anyone. But there are parallels here that I think are useful to deepening Jimenez's story, and they just take too long to get to them. So here's our final clip from this section.
Vicky didn't have much control in her life, so she focused on the things she could control, like how her house looked.
I wanted my house immaculate. I wanted my kids' clothes folded this way. Wanted where you can walk on my floor with white socks. I just like a clean house.
It was difficult to keep a clean house with two young kids. If TJ didn't do what Vicky said, he'd feel his mother's wrath.
He got his ass kicked. Even Angela said the other day, she says that, I never remember you hitting me when you were sober, only when you were drinking. So, and if there was a spoon or a dish in the sink, I woke their asses up at 3 o'clock in the morning and made them wash them. I said, you think I'm working two jobs for me? You're wearing Nikes, I'm wearing Payless.
I mean, here we kind of are in the forge of it. And like I said, you're almost an hour into the story. So, yeah, I think it probably should have been a Sunday magazine piece, perhaps a couple of them. I think it probably should have been reordered, and I think that it's possible Frank Maine is not fully invested in this project, which no doubt the executive editor's like, it's all podcasts now, and he's like, well, I already did this research on Jimenez, and, you know, I think that, listeners, you would probably be better off Googling Frank Maine Jimenez and just reading stuff that he'd already written about it, because this just doesn't go.
Yeah, I mean, I feel kind of bad just two episodes in, just giving up on it. But again, it's not, it hasn't been set up, and it hasn't demonstrated things in a way that makes me very optimistic about going forward. Like, I'm sure there's probably some weird twists and turns to come, but it's not set up in a way that would, you know, encourage like insight or like analysis or anything that would make it anything more than just a like, oh shit story.
Yeah. There's sort of nothing to suggest that now that all the pieces are in place, it's going to click or it's going to like go into a higher gear. And the fact is, in 2014, maybe you could be a little more painstaking and leave a little more room in the front of the narrative in this way. But in 2019, like, as we record this, it's International Podcasters Day or whatever.
It is.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, my kids didn't get me anything.
I know.
Ingrates. I'll wake them up at 3 a.m.
Yeah, do it.
I'm not doing this podcasting for me.
Yeah. Is that a spoon in the sink?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I mean, again,
I'm wearing Payless.
I agree with you. Like, I do feel a little bad. I think that it's well-intentioned, and it's, again, it's not incompetent. I've listened to far duller and more inept work, but... Yeah. This is like right now where we are in true crime podcasting. It's not good enough. So Motive, like I said, the link will be in the show notes, but I would suggest Googling Frank Maine Jimenez. It might be a better use of listeners' time. Moving on to our second most wanted topic. This is the Australian podcast Unraveled, season 4, which is called Snowball. Here's the case file from the Snowball landing page. This season's story swerves away from unsolved murder and into the giddy world of love fraud. Kiwi-born Ollie Wards chronicles how his brother's whirlwind romance with a charismatic Californian con woman, name of my sex tape, ultimately cost his family more than $1 million. With kooky plot twists to rival a Hollywood movie, the 7-episode series follows Ollie from sleepy suburban New Zealand on an international investigation spanning Hawaii, the UK, and the US. Hawaii is part of the US. Sorry, Kiwis. The world of Leslie Manoukian, Leslie with a Z, of course, is full of wild dreams, a lavish lifestyle, big loves and broken promises, and exotic locations. A hall of mirrors, equal parts fantasy and real. It soon becomes clear to Ollie that his family's story is just one piece of a bigger jigsaw, and the only way he can put the puzzle together is by tracking down Leslie herself. End quote. Dun, dun, dun. That is pretty sweaty. But I really liked this podcast. I haven't gotten far, but the whole thing dropped at the beginning of last month. It is only 7 episodes. People have been recommending this podcast generally to me for a while now. I found it very likable, and I will keep going with it. What did you think overall?
Well, I listened to the whole thing.
Okay. There you go.
Yeah. So yeah, it's good. It's good. I, you know, as we talk about it, I might like spoil a little bit about the end, if that's okay.
Yeah, fine with me. Listeners, just be aware if you haven't gotten through the whole thing, you may want to skip ahead.
When I get to the spoiler parts, I'll mention it.
All right. I'm certainly fine with it. Were you also caught up on who the hell is Hamish?
You know, I feel like I've listened to that, but I can't for the life of me remember what. I don't know if we reviewed it on Crime Writers.
I think you did.
Yeah, we probably did. I honestly don't remember.
I liked it pretty well, but I haven't finished it yet because see all of my previous comments in Ray, there being a gazillion podcasts. I liked this better. I liked Who the Hell is Hamish, but I liked this better. There's just something about the way that they, the timing of the dropping of the breadcrumbs about her being a con, that this guy, Ollie Wards, is interviewing his brother who was and his parents who were the big mark. So you have this investigation and this, you know, he's doing a journalism, as we say about 90210 and again with this, but he's also, there's also this familial, almost teasing and a gentle, like, do you hear yourself? I mean, I just think it's really well done, and I consume a lot of material about cons and scams, and the way this is built is very, I mean, it's professional, but it's also like welcoming. Like, I loved Dirty John also, but that felt very machined in some ways.
Yep.
And this is a little more rough around the edges, but in a good way.
Yeah, it's like you're on a ride along. You know, you're in the passenger seat with this guy as he like digs into this crazy story.
Yeah,
that involved his brother and his family.
And there are also myriad opportunities for the listener to feel not superior, but just sort of like, oh, well, that, you know, that's a red flag. Let me play clip 6.
It was like I'm a backpacker and I'm in one of the world's financial capitals getting beer rained on me.
So you felt like a bit of a rock star or something?
Yeah, I did, to be fair. Yes.
Greg's friend Andy did wonder where it was all coming from.
She said, oh, it's all going on the tabs of different local law firms. So, you know, that all come to settle up and there'd be a few extra platters and bottles of wine. And it was just one of her crafty ways of showing all her friends a good time, I suppose.
Leslie was the manager of this restaurant. She could easily just comp the stuff. So why didn't she do that? So that's an example of my sort of being like, well, you know, that's a tell, because if you're the manager, etc. But this is also one of the many places where the podcast points out in a very sympathetic, compassionate manner that people in their early to mid-20s who are paycheck to paycheck and will go to the opening of an envelope if they think there's going to be free wine, even if it's bad. Okay, that happened to me well into my late 30s, but shut up.
Yeah. When did that stop?
It hasn't. It hasn't. I thought that was really smartly done, the way they would occasionally mention that aspect of how this con was able to succeed, that when you're like 23 and free beer and wings are coming to the table, you don't question it. 10 years, 20 years later in your life, you're like, this is weird.
Although, have you gotten to California yet?
No.
All right. Here's a quick spoiler. So advance, hit the 30 seconds forward a few times.
Okay.
When they go to California, they meet this guy who's probably, they don't say exactly, but he's probably in his late 40s, early 50s. Like, he's probably my age. And she had basically, like, moved in with, like, became his girlfriend and got him to invest in a restaurant. So she opens another restaurant in California with this guy's money. And what's his face? The narrator asks one of his friends, like, what the hell? What's the story? And how did he let this happen? And the guy's basically like, he came home to like a packed bowl, a martini, and a blowjob, and he just didn't really think about it much beyond that.
I mean, and I was like, okay. There's also that angle. Sure.
So, but what she does is she plays she's like the cool girl, right? I mean, that's her angle, at least at this part, is that she's, you know, she's not like demanding.
Yeah.
Like she does, all the stuff that she does, she's doing kind of, you know, behind the scenes. And she's like, have you gotten to the part where she's forging documents and stuff?
No.
Yeah. You're not very far into this at all. Oh, all right.
But I mean, here's the thing. I'm going to finish it because I just love that you're being given this insight because you are talking to, you are hearing from the marks and the victims, and the sort of psychology of the victim of the con. This podcast is laying bare how this happens, but is also very compassionate towards the mark. When Greg goes to California and he's expecting this like fairly lavish house and it's not that, and then even after they have their wedding like at City Hall, they're still not allowed to be in the same bedroom at her parents' house. And then it turns out that when she said that her father like furnished tanks to the armed forces, it's not exactly what you would assume. Clip 7.
I think she told me he built tanks for the US Army, which to be fair is kind of true. But when somebody says that they're building tanks for the Army, you don't think water tanks.
Look, he was a smart guy. He was an engineer. He was Iranian. He was born in Tehran, but he was Armenian.
Leslie's dad.
Yeah.
Adopted father.
I never, no one's, as far as I know, well, least of all us, has met the biological parents. She was adopted.
Right. Okay. I didn't know that. But, man, that
brings in the other piece. That actually is where the trust fund supposedly came from, was from her biological parents and what she got left behind. And then she was adopted out.
So somebody adopted a baby with a trust fund.
I mean, that's not how anything has ever worked, ever. Yeah. It seems like, first of all, Greg still maybe believes some of these stories. He's like, oh yeah, they adopted a baby with a trust fund, and then she was smuggled out of the Armenian neighborhood of Tehran. And Ollie's like, uh-huh, a baby with a trust fund. All right. And then in the next clip, which immediately follows the one we just heard, Greg is sort of trying to justify the fact that he, the frog, did not leap out of the water in clip 8.
You know, there's so many facets to someone's personality or stories or all or otherwise. Eventually, you actually just kind of give up asking and accept some of it and live in the moment and move on.
It just seems like bullshit, you know?
Well, most of it is.
Nice.
I mean, Greg seems like just one of those fascinating people. He's like, yeah, you know, she's horrible, but what could I do? Like, well, like, I can think of a couple of things, but I think we've all sort of been in that situation, especially when you're in functionally late adolescence.
Yeah.
And the situation is absolutely not as it's been described to you, but you're like, well, I'm all the way in California. I guess I'm going to see this through. And if she was furnishing, you know, bulls and blowjobs.
I don't know if that was her, if that was her strategy with him, but maybe so he does a fair amount of like beating himself up about this stuff too, where he's just like, I was the perfect mark. You know, she just saw me and she just knew, which is, you know, it's kind of endearing.
I think that's probably true. Like the description of their initial meeting is that he spotted her in the garden at a party and she was having a cigarette and he didn't smoke, but he decided to pretend to talk to her.
Cause he loves Americans.
Yeah.
And he thought she looked like Kim Kardashian.
Oh my God. And his little detail that he like produces I've got a $2 note. Like,
Oh God.
He's like, I think they're lucky for rare North Koreans. I'm like, they're lucky for everybody, man. My grandma's neighbor gave me one every year for my birthday, as long as she was alive, which was for a while. I was still getting them when I was like 37.
Nice.
But I was like, of all the Americana.
Yeah.
The Jefferson. That's amazing. Love it.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff. And I think it, you know, for people who haven't listened to the whole thing, there's a good payoff.
I mean,
there's a good payoff.
I do like the way it's ordered because I feel like you're kind of sometimes with podcasts like this, they're like, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. And then you return like, you know, Bakersfield, 1958. And then you have to sort of start at the beginning, already basically knowing the end. On this one, you're like going on this journey of retrospective discovery with Ollie Ward's. And I think that's the smart way to do it. And he's not cheating it at all, at least as far as I've gotten, which again is not far, but I just think it's set up really well and that it's very personable and everyone in it is sympathetic, but at the same time, it does let the listener feel like, you know, maybe I would have spotted that, maybe not. And it does give you a good kind of sliced open, like cross section of, well, this is how this was accomplished, possibly. In our last clip, we'll hear what I think was probably a huge red flag, but again, it was kind of too late by that point. Only on television does someone have none of their own friends, like none, in the wedding party or at the wedding. Weddings can tell you a lot if you let them. It's almost never good information. Here's clip 9.
Preparations were underway for a massive wedding. But it soon became clear that none of Leslie's trust fund friends from America were going to make it. She said none of them could hack the 13-hour flight to Auckland. So Kiwi girls that Leslie had known for only a matter of months started getting the call up to the bridal party, like Carla, who was back in London.
I remember sitting at my desk in Hoxton and at my office, and I remember thinking, fuck, this is so weird, and sort of saying to a few of the girls in the showroom, like, so I've just asked me to be a bridesmaid to this girl I barely know in New Zealand in January.
One of the other bridesmaids, Alicia, hadn't known Leslie for long either.
I was asked to be a bridesmaid, which was quite surprising.
Well, I think she said something about her cousin couldn't come. So I think I was kind of filling in. Like, she didn't really have any family here. And yeah, I mean, I guess I was happy to do it because we were close at the time.
After everything that went down, my mum stopped referring to it as the wedding. She renamed it. In our family, it's now known as the event.
The incident. I just find them very like everyone who is on the mic is very likable and very relatable, especially in the way that many of like the bridesmaids, Greg's friends from uni, whatever, are like, you sort of get used to on something like 48 Hours or Serial, someone having a more orotund way of describing their reactions. It's like, in retrospect, I did find it somewhat odd. And these people are like, that's right. Fucking weird, right? And I'm like, right. Yes, it is. And that's exactly how you listeners would talk to each other about it. Or like my best friend and I would be like, that's fucked up, right? So yeah, I mean, I really like that about it, and I'm excited to keep listening to it.
So a couple things. One, I thought it was hilarious when he said that his dad sounds like Murray from Flight of the Conchords.
Does he?
Yeah. Maybe you haven't got to that point yet, but he's like...
No, that part I did hear, but I was like, okay, I've watched one episode of that, so I'm not...
Watched one episode? Oh, Flight of the Conchords is hysterical, and Murray especially so. Anyway, so there's that, and... Like, as you'll see, there's definitely interesting twists and stuff that kind of comes up. And then there's this, you know, there's stuff that doesn't get figured out in the end. Some stuff does, like, it's definitely satisfying, but it's also sort of, I guess, true enough that for me at least, like, one of the big questions just doesn't get answered at all. And they kind of acknowledge it. It is actually right at the point where I was like, well, what about this? And then they kind of talk about how they couldn't really figure it out.
Okay.
But the only downside for me, and again, I'm not going to try and spoil anything, they do a little bit of sort of trying to, you know, be philosophical about it, or what are the lessons learned and stuff. And that falls a little flat, like right at the very end.
Yeah,
like, I didn't think.
I never enjoy those wrap ups. Yeah. And it's like, fall for scam artists. Like, there's kind of nothing else to say about it. And that's not.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's not really giving away anything, but it's like, was the biggest victim of this whole thing not Leslie herself?
No,
you know,
I'm just going to say,
and it's
no.
Like, like, that is like not the lesson. Like,
no,
even if you think that's a lesson,
hold my free beer that you got me. Cause no, she's not.
Yeah. That's like the sixth grade book report lesson. I thought that the biggest victim was the perpetrator. So, yeah, but otherwise, I think it's good. And again, I mean, we were talking before about, you know, in this sort of very cluttered true crime area of the podcast realm, it's like, how do you, like, stick out? And yeah. I think in this case, I think the storytelling and just the general sort of, you know, they're just likable people. you know, and in a way that seems kind of remarkable, are not really bitter, but they do want to know.
Yeah, there's about a lot of dark humor from what I've heard. And again, this is, you know, they get right to it. Like, you open at the fireworks factory, smart. Like, that's what you have to do. And as I said, this is perfectly professional, but it's not slick and it's not glib. It's like you feel that it's genuine and that you're not being manipulated by pacing or like moving the timeline around or flashbacks or anything like that. So I can't wait to finish
it continues. And I also think that, unlike Motive, where I think it's trying to put a frame around its story, like in this case, it just telling the story is adequate, I think, based on how they do it, and how, you know, you're kind of on this journey with this family, and in particular the one guy who's narrating it, and it's just a very interesting sort of follow along, experience.
Absolutely, and like this isn't, you don't have to get real high concept with it. It's a con. They want to know what happened. That's it. And there's going to be people who are down for that, including me. And it sounds like you. So I'm glad that that was a good use of your time, even if the first one, maybe not so much. Speaking of good uses of time, Toby, what else are you working on? Please tell the listeners.
Well, as always, I'm on Crime Writers On, which drops on Mondays. And I also do the Deep Dive True Crime Book Club, which is on our Patreon feed, which Sarah has been on many times. And the most recent one was talking about the new Jim Crow with Madeline Barron of In the Dark fame.
Nice.
And Marsha Chatelain, who's been on, I think, Undisclosed, but is a professor at Georgetown.
Yeah, she was just on this fine podcast a couple weeks ago.
Oh, she was? Yeah. Oh, so your listeners know how awesome she is. And then Shirley Lairo, who's teaches at, and I'm going to get this slightly wrong, but it's the Borough of Manhattan Community College, I think it's what it is. But it's a really interesting conversation, which I just tried to stay out of as much as possible.
All right, Toby, thanks for coming down from the roof. I always appreciate it.
All right, thank you. Fun as always.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, Stephanie Early Green on Scam Goddess and Ghost Hunting with H.H. Holmes. I don't even know. After that, Paul Holes has a true crime show and Mike Dunn is going to come back to talk about it. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And at Eve Beatty's and my true crime review newsletter, Best Evidence, bestevidence.fyi. Once again, 2,000 paid subscribers by August of next year, and we cover the Theranos trial. If you like the podcast, please tell a friend and rate it on iTunes. And if you don't like the podcast, please don't tell anyone. My guest has been Toby Ball. He's on Twitter at TobyBallNH. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.